A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants a guide to the U.S. Constitution for non-Americans. What it actually says, why it was written, and what each major amendment means for everyday life, government power, and individual rights. And honestly, this is one of those topics where the gap between what people think they know and what's actually in the document is enormous.
It really is. Most Americans can't name more than a handful of amendments, and for people outside the US, the whole thing can seem baffling. This short, old document that somehow governs everything from what you can post online to who can carry a gun in a grocery store. And the timing of this question is good. We're heading into midterm elections. The Supreme Court just finished another term that reshaped gun laws and abortion access, and understanding the constitutional framework is basically the decoder ring for American news.
Let's start with the obvious question. Why does the United States even have a written constitution? The UK doesn't. Israel doesn't. These are functioning democracies with no single constitutional document.
Right. And the answer is that the Constitution was solving a very specific problem. Before it, the United States operated under the Articles of Confederation, which created a central government so weak it couldn't tax, couldn't regulate commerce between states, and couldn't raise an army. It was basically a loose alliance of 13 mini-countries that all hated each other's trade policies. By 1787, it was clear the whole thing was falling apart. Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts. Armed farmers shutting down courts because they were being thrown off their land, and the federal government couldn't do anything about it. Didn't have the power.
The Constitution was essentially a centralization project dressed up in Enlightenment philosophy.
That's a very corn way to put it, but yes. The framers gathered in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, Madison, Hamilton, Washington, Franklin, and they drafted a document that created three branches of government with actual teeth. The key innovation was separation of powers with checks and balances. Congress makes laws, the president enforces them, the courts interpret them, and each branch has ways to limit the others. The president can veto legislation. Congress can override that veto with a two-thirds majority. The courts can strike down laws as unconstitutional. Congress can impeach judges and presidents. It's a machine designed to make ambition check ambition, as Madison put it in Federalist No. 51.
The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, that wasn't part of the original document.
And this is crucial to understanding the whole thing. The original Constitution was mostly about structure, how the government would work, not what it couldn't do to you. That terrified the Anti-Federalists, who saw the whole project as a power grab. Several states only agreed to ratify on the condition that a Bill of Rights would be added immediately. James Madison, who had initially opposed the idea, he thought listing specific rights would imply that unlisted rights didn't exist, ultimately drafted 12 amendments, 10 of which were ratified in 1791.
Which is how you get the weird situation where the First Amendment isn't first because it was most important, but because the original First Amendment, about congressional apportionment, was never ratified, and the original Second Amendment, about congressional pay, took 202 years to pass and became the 27th.
That's one of my favorite constitutional trivia facts. The 27th Amendment was proposed by James Madison in 1789 as part of the original Bill of Rights, and it just sat there for two centuries until a college student named Gregory Watson wrote a paper about it in 1982, got a C-, and then launched a one-man crusade to get it ratified. It finally passed in 1992. A C- paper changed the Constitution.
The most Gen X constitutional amendment.
Let's get into the actual amendments, because that's what the prompt is really asking about. And I want to start with the First Amendment, because it's the one that most distinguishes the United States from other democracies. It protects five things: freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, and petition. But the American version of free speech is radically broader than what you find in Europe or Canada.
This is the one where Americans can say things that would get you arrested in Germany.
Germany bans Nazi symbols and Holocaust denial. Canada's hate speech laws criminalize public statements that incite hatred against identifiable groups. France prohibits denying crimes against humanity. None of those restrictions would survive a First Amendment challenge in the United States. The Supreme Court has consistently held that even hateful, offensive, and false speech is protected. The remedy for bad speech, in the American framework, is more speech, not government censorship.
Which sounds noble until you're the target of a coordinated harassment campaign, and the government's position is basically, sorry, nothing we can do.
That's the tension, and it's real. But the protection also extends to political speech in ways that matter enormously. The 2010 case, Citizens United versus FEC, held that corporate spending on political ads is protected speech. That's unthinkable in most democracies. The First Amendment also means the government can't establish an official religion or prevent you from practicing yours. This is why you see those constant battles over nativity scenes on government property and prayer in schools. The Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause are in constant tension.
Let's move to the Second Amendment, because this one genuinely confuses non-Americans. The text is, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That reads like it's about militias, not personal gun ownership.
For most of American history, that's how courts interpreted it. The Second Amendment was understood as protecting the right of states to maintain militias, what became the National Guard. The idea that it guarantees an individual right to own a handgun for self-defense is barely two decades old. The Supreme Court's 2008 decision in District of Columbia versus Heller changed everything. Justice Scalia's majority opinion held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess firearms unconnected to militia service. The 2022 Bruin decision went further, striking down New York's concealed carry law and establishing that gun regulations must be consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation.
A complete reinterpretation in less than 20 years.
That's what makes the Second Amendment uniquely American. No other developed country has a constitutional right to gun ownership. Canada, Australia, the UK, Japan. They all regulate firearms as a matter of public policy, not constitutional law. In the US, any gun control measure has to survive a constitutional challenge, and the current Supreme Court is deeply skeptical of most restrictions. That said, the right isn't unlimited. The court has acknowledged that restrictions on felons, the mentally ill, and dangerous and unusual weapons, like machine guns, are constitutional. But the trend line is clear: more guns, fewer restrictions.
The Fourth Amendment feels like it's been stretched to the breaking point by digital technology. Protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, warrants based on probable cause. But what does search mean when your entire life is in a cloud server?
This is where the legal doctrine gets fascinating. The key case is Katz versus United States from 1967, which established the reasonable expectation of privacy test. If you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in something, the government needs a warrant to access it. If you don't, like something you shared publicly, they don't. The problem is that in the digital age, we voluntarily handed enormous amounts of data to third parties, phone companies, email providers, social media platforms. The third-party doctrine says that if you've shared information with a third party, you've lost your reasonable expectation of privacy. The government can get your cell phone location data from your carrier without a warrant under this logic.
Which is absurd. My phone knows where I sleep. That's not something I've chosen to share with the police.
The Supreme Court actually agreed with you, at least partially. In Carpenter versus United States in 2018, the court held that accessing 7 days of historical cell site location data is a search under the Fourth Amendment and requires a warrant. But the decision was narrow. It didn't overturn the third-party doctrine, it just carved out an exception for long-term location tracking. Email, bank records, browsing history, those are still largely unprotected.
The Fifth Amendment is the one everyone knows from police procedurals. You have the right to remain silent.
The Miranda warning, yes. That comes from Miranda versus Arizona in 1966. The Fifth Amendment actually does several things. It protects against self-incrimination. That's the pleading the fifth you hear in congressional hearings. It prohibits double jeopardy. You can't be tried twice for the same crime. It requires grand jury indictments for serious federal crimes. And it includes the takings clause. The government can't take your private property for public use without paying just compensation. That last one is the source of endless litigation over eminent domain, especially after the Kelo versus New London decision in 2005, which allowed the government to seize private property and transfer it to a private developer for economic development purposes.
That case was wild. A city took someone's house to give the land to Pfizer for a research facility that was never built, and the Supreme Court said that was fine.
It prompted a massive backlash. Something like 45 states passed laws restricting eminent domain after Kelo. It's actually a perfect example of how constitutional interpretation can provoke democratic responses. The court says the Constitution allows something, the public recoils, and the political process adjusts.
Let's jump to the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. These are the ones that tried to rebuild the country after the Civil War.
They're arguably more important than the Bill of Rights for understanding modern American law. The 13th Amendment, ratified in 1865, abolished slavery and involuntary servitude. But, and this is the part that gets overlooked, it contains an exception clause. Slavery and involuntary servitude are prohibited except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. That little clause has had enormous consequences. It's the constitutional basis for prison labor, which is a massive industry in the United States. Incarcerated people can be forced to work for pennies an hour or nothing, and it's perfectly constitutional.
The loophole that built a prison industrial complex.
And then the 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868, this is the most litigated amendment in the entire Constitution. It has several clauses, but the two that matter most are the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause. No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
This is where the incorporation doctrine comes from, right? The idea that the Bill of Rights applies to state governments, not just the federal government.
Yes, and this is a misconception worth correcting. Originally, the Bill of Rights only restricted the federal government. If your state violated your free speech rights, the First Amendment didn't help you. The 14th Amendment changed that. The Supreme Court gradually incorporated most of the Bill of Rights against the states through the Due Process Clause. The First Amendment was incorporated in 1925. The Second Amendment wasn't incorporated until 2010 with McDonald v. Chicago. The Third Amendment, the one about quartering soldiers, has never been incorporated because the issue just hasn't come up.
The 14th Amendment is also the foundation for most of the rights Americans now consider fundamental.
It's the constitutional basis for the right to marry whomever you choose. That was Loving v. Virginia in 1967 for interracial marriage and Obergefell v. Hodges in 2015 for same-sex marriage. It was the basis for Roe v. Wade in 1973, which protected abortion rights, until Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health overturned it in 2022. The court in Dobbs said the right to abortion wasn't deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition, which is the test for whether an unenumerated right is protected by the Due Process Clause.
The same amendment that protected abortion for 50 years was also used to abolish that protection. That's not a flaw in the text. It's a feature of how the court works.
The text didn't change. The justices did. And that's the fundamental reality of American constitutional law. It's not really about the text. It's about who's reading it.
The 15th Amendment prohibited racial discrimination in voting, ratified in 1870, and then basically ignored for a century.
The 15th Amendment says the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And southern states immediately figured out workarounds, poll taxes, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, outright violence and intimidation. It took the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to actually enforce the 15th Amendment, and that required the civil rights movement, Bloody Sunday and Selma, and Lyndon Johnson's political muscle. And then in 2013, the Supreme Court's Shelby County v. Holder decision gutted a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, the preclearance requirement that forced states with a history of discrimination to get federal approval before changing their voting laws. Within hours of the decision, several states announced new voting restrictions.
The 19th Amendment, women's suffrage, has a similar story of delay, ratified in 1920, but it took 72 years of activism to get there. And even then, Native American women and Asian American women were still excluded from voting in many states until the 1940s and 50s.
The amendment itself is one sentence. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. It's stunningly simple for something that required a multi-generational political battle. And it's worth noting that the first Women's Rights Convention was at Seneca Falls in 1848, 72 years from that meeting to ratification. Anthony died in 1906, 14 years before the amendment she'd devoted her life to finally passed.
The 26th Amendment lowered the voting age to 18. That one actually moved fast, proposed and ratified in 1971, driven entirely by the Vietnam War. The slogan was old enough to fight, old enough to vote.
It passed in just 100 days, the fastest ratification of any amendment in American history. When you're drafting 18-year-olds to die in Southeast Asia, it becomes very hard to argue they shouldn't have a say in who sends them there.
Let's talk about the amendment process itself, because this is what most non-Americans don't understand. Why are there only 27 amendments in 235 years?
Because the process is intentionally brutal. Article 5 of the Constitution lays it out. An amendment can be proposed either by a two-thirds vote in both houses of Congress or by a convention called by two-thirds of the state legislatures. That second method has never been used. Then it must be ratified by three-quarters of the states, either through their legislatures or through state conventions. That's 38 states today. Getting two-thirds of Congress and 38 states to agree on anything is almost impossible in a polarized country.
Which is why the Equal Rights Amendment, first proposed in 1923, still hasn't been ratified. It says, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. But it's been stuck in limbo for a century.
The ERA actually passed Congress in 1972 and went to the states for ratification. Congress set a 7-year deadline, later extended to 10 years. By 1982, only 35 states had ratified, 3 short. Some states have ratified since then, but the legal status is deeply contested. The Archivist of the United States hasn't certified it. Courts have been asked to weigh in. It's a mess, and it perfectly illustrates how the amendment process can stall even when there's broad public support.
The amendments that do pass tend to be structural or procedural, not rights expanding. The last truly rights expanding amendment was the 26th in 1971. Since then, we've had the 27th, congressional pay, and before that, the 25th on presidential succession, the 24th banning poll taxes, and the 23rd giving D.C. electoral votes. Nothing since 1971 that created a new individual right.
Which brings us to the central tension of modern constitutional law. If the amendment process is frozen, and it basically is, then all constitutional change has to come through the Supreme Court. And that means the meaning of the Constitution changes dramatically depending on who sits on the court. The same 14th Amendment that was read to protect abortion rights in 1973 was read to not protect them in 2022. The text didn't change. The court did.
For a non-American trying to understand U.S. politics, the practical takeaway is pay attention to Supreme Court cases, not just presidential elections. The president serves 4 or 8 years. A Supreme Court justice serves for life.
The current court is the most conservative in nearly a century. 6 of the 9 justices were appointed by Republican presidents. 3 were appointed by Donald Trump alone. The average age of the conservative justices is significantly lower than the liberal justices, meaning this majority could last for decades. We're already seeing the effects. Expanded gun rights in Bruin, overturned abortion rights in Dobbs, curtailed environmental regulation authority in West Virginia versus EPI, expanded religious accommodation in the workplace. This is a court that's systematically shifting the law rightward, and it's doing it through constitutional interpretation, not legislation.
There's a misconception worth addressing here. A lot of non-Americans hear the Constitution and imagine it's a detailed rulebook. It's not. It's about 4,500 words. You can read the whole thing in under an hour. Most of its meaning comes from 200 plus years of Supreme Court opinions interpreting those words.
Those interpretations can shift dramatically. For decades, the court said the Constitution permitted separate but equal racial segregation. That was Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896. Then in 1954, Brown v. Board of Education unanimously said segregation in public schools violates the Equal Protection Clause. Same text, completely opposite interpretation. The Constitution didn't change.
Another misconception. The First Amendment means you can say anything, anywhere, without consequences. It doesn't. It only restricts government censorship. Your employer can fire you for what you say. Twitter can ban you. Your friends can ostracize you. The First Amendment is a shield against the state, not against social consequences.
That distinction is frequently lost on people who invoke free speech when a private platform removes their post. It's also worth noting that the First Amendment doesn't protect everything. True threats, incitement to imminent lawless action, obscenity as defined by the Miller test, defamation, fraud. Those are all unprotected categories. The boundaries of those categories are constantly being litigated, but they exist.
The Constitution didn't create a democracy either. It created a republic with some distinctly anti-democratic features. The Electoral College means a candidate can lose the popular vote by millions and still become president, which happened in 2000 and again in 2016. The Senate gives Wyoming, with about 600,000 people, the same representation as California, with about 39 million. Supreme Court justices are appointed for life with no electoral accountability whatsoever.
Some of those features were deliberate compromises. Small states wouldn't have joined the Union without equal Senate representation. The Electoral College was partly a concession to slave states, which got to count 3/5 of their enslaved population for electoral vote allocation without letting those people vote. Other anti-democratic features are just artifacts. Lifetime judicial appointments made more sense when life expectancy was 60. Now a justice appointed at 48 can serve for 35 or 40 years.
If the amendment process is frozen, and the court is where constitutional change actually happens, what's the future? Will the U.S. ever pass another major amendment?
I'm skeptical. The closest recent attempts, the ERA, a balanced budget amendment, congressional term limits, have all failed. The political alignment required to get 2/3 of Congress and 38 states is almost unimaginable in the current environment. What's more likely is continued fluctuation through the court. And there's an emerging debate about whether the current conservative majority will continue the 20th century pattern of expanding rights, or whether it will actively narrow them and return questions to the states.
That's already happening. Dobbs didn't ban abortion. It said the Constitution doesn't protect it, and each state gets to decide. The result is a patchwork where abortion is a felony in Texas and a protected right in California. That's the return to the states model, and it's probably the template for future decisions.
For non-Americans trying to follow this, that's the key insight. When you see a Supreme Court case about guns or abortion or environmental regulation, you're not watching a court resolve a legal dispute. You're watching a court decide what the Constitution means, and those decisions are effectively permanent unless and until the court reverses itself or a constitutional amendment passes, neither of which happens often.
The Constitution is ultimately a framework for disagreement, not a set of answers. That's what makes it both durable and maddening. It doesn't tell you whether abortion should be legal or whether you can carry a gun in a subway. It tells you who gets to decide, and then the fight over who decides never actually ends.
That fight has been going on since 1787. The same arguments about federal versus state power, individual rights versus collective interests, judicial restraint versus judicial engagement. They've been running on a loop for 2 centuries. The names and the specific issues change, but the structure of the argument is basically the same. Madison and Hamilton were having versions of the arguments we're having now.
The one practical thing I'd tell a non-American who wants to understand U.S. politics, learn the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment. That's about 1.5 pages of text, and it will explain more about American political fights than a year of cable news. Everything else is commentary.
Follow the Supreme Court's docket. The big cases are announced in June, and they shape American life more durably than any single piece of legislation or executive order. A president's policies can be reversed by the next president. A Supreme Court precedent can stand for 50 years or more, and when it falls, the aftershocks ripple through every state legislature, every lower court, and millions of individual lives.
The Constitution is short, vague, and almost impossible to amend. That combination means the 9 people in black robes effectively write the most important parts of American law. It's not what the framers intended, but it's what the system evolved into. And understanding that the real Constitution is what the court says it is the beginning of understanding American governance. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the interwar period, linguists studying Basque discovered that its ergative case marking, where the subject of a transitive verb takes a special suffix, but the subject of an intransitive verb does not, functions optically like a polarization filter on a camera lens, selectively distinguishing agent from experiencer in a way that mirrors how polarized light suppresses certain wavelengths while allowing others to pass through unchanged.
I'm going to need a minute with that one.
The polarization filter of grammar.
The Constitution is a document, but constitutional law is a living, contested process that's both its greatest strength and the source of its endless conflict. The framers built a machine for channeling disagreement. They didn't pretend disagreement would ever end. 235 years later, the machine is still running, and the arguments are louder than ever.
If you're outside the United States watching American politics and wondering why everything seems to end up in court, why every policy debate becomes a constitutional crisis, why 9 unelected judges have the final word on the most intimate decisions of private life, now you know. It's not a bug. It's the design.
This episode was produced by Hilbert Flemingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.